I'd like now to welcome Max Blumenthal. He is a journalist, blogger, and Nation Institute Writing Fellow whose work has appeared in many publications, including the New York Times, the Los Angeles Times, the Nation, the Daily Beast, and the Huffington Post. His new book is called Goliath, Life and Loathing in Greater Israel. His presentation at the Lenzik this Friday night, October 10th, is sold out, but we will be broadcasting it here on KSFR on Sunday, October 19th at 3:30 in the afternoon. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thanks for having me.
So you worked on this book, Goliath, for 4 years. You spent a lot of time in Israel, and you paint a picture of Israeli society in which the separation of Jewish Israelis and Palestinians begins at a very early age. You describe, for example, in the book, a group of preschoolers being taught from a poster that reads, "Who wants to kill us?" What's going on?
Well, yeah, the poster was placed in a preschool in Holon, which is a suburb of Tel Aviv. And this was in a semi-secular preschool. And the children were asked, "Who wants to kill them?" They were told that, you know, the traditional enemies of the Jewish people want to kill them, or the perceived enemies, from Egyptians to Persians to, of course, Nazis and then Palestinians. And then they were told that, you know, the way to not be killed is to have a state, of course, a state free of those elements, so free of potentially anti-Semitic Gentiles, free of Arabs and Palestinians, and therefore an exclusively Jewish state. And those values are inculcated into the Jewish citizens of the state of Israel from a very early age in order to produce nationalistic and militaristic attitudes. And those attitudes have increased and intensified since the Second Intifada, when Israel began to impose this regime of unilateral separation, manifested in this vast separation wall, 638 kilometers of concrete that cuts deep into the West Bank, separating people really along ethnic lines, and the siege of the Gaza Strip, which is designed to permanently ghettoize the population of the Gaza Strip, who are 80% refugees, meaning they used to have property and land inside what is now Israel. They can't return because they're not Jewish. That's how you maintain a Jewish state, and it's a tough project, and it's a project that has side effects, very ugly side effects. One of them is the militarization of the education system that I describe in detail in my book, and that's done just because this project has to be maintained not by a small professional class, but by all of Jewish Israeli society. Every man and woman is conscripted into the Israeli army at age 18 to maintain the attitudes, to produce the attitudes among young people that are required to willingly go into a military that's been engaged in a 50-year-long occupation, to do things that normal people don't want to do. The natural skepticism of teens has to be overwhelmed, and it's done in the education system, and it's done through, this is accomplished through societal leaders, including state-funded rabbis, teachers, and political leaders, most notably Benjamin Netanyahu. And my book really explains, it goes deep into the system of Israeli society that maintains control over Palestinian society. It shows how it operates and what terrible side effects it's had on the society itself, and especially its young people.
As you said, the training in militarism starts very young. It starts in kindergarten. It goes pretty much unbroken. And, for example, there's a ban on textbooks in Israel that talk about Nakba. Can you tell us what the meaning is of the word Nakba and why it's banned?
Well, the word Nakba means catastrophe, and it's the Palestinian word to refer directly to the expulsion of 750,000 indigenous Palestinians between 1947 and 1948, which was necessary to create a Jewish state with a Jewish demographic majority. And those people and their children and grandchildren are not allowed to return to what is now Israel. They live in permanent exile as long as there's a Jewish state. But the Nakba is a continuing process, partly because there are 1.5 million non-Jews inside Israel who are Palestinian, who are considered a threat to the state's ethnic purity, and because there are Palestinians in the West Bank where Israel's expanding its colonial project through the settlement enterprise. And so the state has continued to to conduct ethnic cleansing on a daily basis. I mean, there hasn't been a day since the state of Israel was established without one act of ethnic cleansing or another. We saw it most recently in the neighborhood of Silwan in East Jerusalem, where 25 families were forced out of their homes by settlers who took over their homes 15 minutes later. And this is happening in Jerusalem all the time. The Israeli police come in, take families' belongings out, put it in their front yard, and some religious extremists take over their home that day. Their homes where a family will live in the living room, and settlers have taken over their kitchen. It's that intimate. And that is just part of the overall logical imperative of creating, maintaining, and expanding an exclusively Jewish state. So for Palestinians, the Nakba is a daily occurrence. And the state of Israel and its right-wing government is very threatened by this narrative. They think that the narrative is producing disloyalty among Palestinian citizens of Israel, who are also part of the Israeli education system. So in the Arab schools, Israel has segregated schools, so there are Jewish and then there are Arab schools. In the Arab schools, they're run tightly by Israel's General Security Service, the Shin Bet, and teachers are not allowed to teach about the Nakba or what's considered the nationalist narrative, the nationalist Palestinian narrative. But not only that, Jewish students are prevented from learning about the Nakba in Israeli public schools. This is since Netanyahu and the Likud government really came into power in a dominant way. And so textbooks that simply referred to the Nakba or said that Palestinians, noted that Palestinians consider 1948 to be a tragedy, were literally pulled off shelves in bookstores by staffers of Netanyahu's government. And the curriculum has been replaced with an extremely nationalist curriculum that emphasizes Jewish studies over civic studies. So civic studies are being de-emphasized. Students are being taken on field trips to occupied Hebron, where Jewish religious sites exist within some of the most extremist settlements. And the militarization and the nationalism-oriented curriculum in the education system has really been ramped up since Netanyahu and his government came into power in 2009, which happens to be where the narrative of my book starts.
Give us a little bit of background in terms of the numbers of Palestinians who've been killed, displaced, and whose houses and villages have been destroyed since the founding of Israel.
Well, that's difficult to quantify, but in 1948 alone, over 400 villages were destroyed, over 750,000 people expelled. Thousands were killed, and there are stories of massacres that are still being revealed, either through state archives or oral testimony. And this has just continued through 1967, when the occupation of the West Bank, the Gaza Strip, and the Golan Heights began, when 350,000 more were expelled, thousands more killed. In the Gaza Strip, during Operation Protective Edge, the war in Gaza this summer, Israel destroyed over 15,000 civilian homes and buildings. I mean, think about that, 15,000. So that adds to the 27,000 homes that Israel's destroyed since 1967. So we're talking about upwards of 40,000 Palestinian civilian homes destroyed. In the Gaza Strip this summer, 89 families, Palestinian families, were completely liquidated. 89 families lost every single member due to Israeli airstrikes and massacres in the Gaza Strip, which usually struck civilian homes where entire families were sheltering with 2,000-pound bombs. Over 800,000 Palestinian olive trees since 1967 have been uprooted, and that is about the size of 33 Central Parks. But if you think of these family trees as uprooted trees, to me, that is so much more disturbing if you consider the escalation of violence, particularly against people in the Gaza Strip. And then beyond that, and what I think the worst aspect is the psychological violence of forcing an entire population to live under siege with no reprieve or legal recourse or means of defending themselves. What that does to people is unquantifiable. It's the daily humiliation in the West Bank and East Jerusalem that does so much damage, and that really speaks to the violence of the occupation as much as the statistics on the deaths do. And that's another thing that I tried to focus on in my book, Goliath, just telling the stories of people who are experiencing this on a daily level.
Yeah, there's so many stories to tell, and so many of them are just heart-wrenching. For example, the story of Dr. Izzeldin Abueliash. He's a fertility doctor whose entire family was killed, and his profession was helping Jewish women have more children.
Right. I mean, he's a doctor who had worked in Israel and was delivering testimony during Operation Cast Lead. This is the attack in 2008 and 2009. Actually was kind of a TV commentator in Israel because he spoke perfect Hebrew. And was just would give a nightly commentary. And during his nightly commentary for Israeli Channel 2, a tank shell flew into his house and decapitated two of his daughters and splattered another child's organs on the wall while he was talking. And the call to watch on YouTube is just, it's gut-wrenching. The Israeli anchor actually was so stunned he had to end the broadcast and walk off air. But it had absolutely no effect on Jewish Israeli society to watch this. Absolutely none. You know, support for the war only increased. And this latest war was more brutal, probably tenfold than the last one. As I said, 89 families were liquidated in this war completely. Hundreds of others lost several members, and I was just in the Gaza Strip. I was in the Gaza Strip during the war, and I didn't meet a single person who wasn't touched by the violence. But the most interesting thing is to meet people like Dr. Abueliash, who's now living in Canada and maintains really friendly relations with the Jewish community there, which is extremely pro-Israel. To meet people like him who are in their 50s and 60s, maybe their 40s, who worked in Israel and speak Hebrew and had known Jewish Israelis, and to meet the younger generation who have only known Israelis through drones, through tanks, and through the occasional incursion of soldiers who are committing massacres. Their view of Israelis and of the situation is obviously more radical than those of their parents' and grandparents' generation. So there's a parallel process of radicalization inside the Gaza Strip and the West Bank, which to me seems deliberate and is aimed at promoting separation, preventing people like Dr. Abueliash from rising to the fore and being able to communicate back to Israeli society or the Jewish diaspora.
We're talking to author and journalist Max Blumenthal. There are, as you're saying, different classes of people living within Israel. Even if somebody is a citizen of Israel, if they're not Jewish, they're not protected in the same way. For example, if your house is bulldozed and you're Palestinian, you have no rights whatsoever. In addition, a lot of anti-democratic laws have been proposed and many of them passed. For example, the criminalization of protest and other laws that limit basic rights. I was wondering if you could talk about these old and new laws that are fundamentally anti-democratic.
Once again, this goes to the heart of the logic of maintaining a Jewish state in an area where most people aren't Jewish, or what you could refer to as the Jewish state in Israel and the Levant, or JSIL. I have more rights as a Jewish American than any Palestinian in the whole world in historic Palestine. I'm not even a citizen of Israel, but I could, within 1 hour of this phone call, and receive state benefits and be treated like a member of the highest rung of the totem pole of Israeli society, whereas Palestinians who have been there for hundreds and even thousands of years would not be able to receive those same rights, even as citizens of the state of Israel. I write about the situation of the Bedouins in the Negev Desert. I mean, these are citizens of the state of Israel who often serve in the Israeli army, who really try to demonstrate their loyalty to the state. And they have been victims of extreme project of ethnic cleansing that's been spelled out into law according to the Praver Plan, which is spelled P-R-A-W-E-R. And it's a plan for the forced expulsion of 80,000 indigenous Bedouin in the Negev Desert, forcing them into Indian reservation-style communities, which are just like Indian reservations in the U.S., extremely poor and filled with people who've been forced off their land and forced away from their ancestral lifestyles. So there's high levels of depression and alcoholism and abuse there as well. And this was being enacted as we speak and kind of ignored because all of the attention is on Gaza. But I visited one of the villages in the Negev Desert and wrote about it in my book. It's called Al-Araqib. And I watched it be wiped off the map by Israeli bulldozers in order to build a Jews-only community and a forest that was to be planted there by the Jewish National Fund, which is a 501c3 nonprofit in the United States that raises money in the U.S. for this kind of ethnic cleansing. And this village, since I visited it and videotaped the destruction there, its residents have consistently rebuilt with the help of Jewish-Israeli allies and international allies, very marginalized forces. And they've been, that village has been destroyed over 70 times since I visited it. So that's what citizens of Israel who just happen to not be Jewish are experiencing in the Negev Desert. An Israeli minister recently called for their population to be limited, for controls to be placed on their population growth, which is, according to international law, incitement to genocide. And then you have the suite of anti-democratic laws which apply to Palestinian citizens of Israel almost exclusively. And there are over 50 of them on the books, maybe over 60. But one of the worst ones is the citizenship and entry law. There's no law like it in any other industrialized country in the world. And it's a law that prevents Palestinian citizens of Israel from marrying Palestinians from the West Bank or the Gaza Strip. It prevents them from reaching who are from the West Bank or the Gaza Strip or Jerusalem. In other words, it prevents people from falling in love with someone from the wrong, who exists under the wrong matrix of Israeli control. I, if I took up Israeli citizenship, could marry a Jewish settler who lives in the West Bank, but a Palestinian could not, just because the state of Israel, in order to maintain a Jewish state, must maintain a Jewish demographic majority, and that means limiting the numbers of non-Jews who live under its control. This law was passed for demographic reasons, to engineer a demographic majority, not for security reasons. And that's what's behind so many of these laws, the laws that make it easy to demolish Palestinian homes in Jerusalem, where most of the demolitions take place. It has to do with limiting the population of Palestinians or non-Jews, demographic manipulation, and something that's completely anachronistic. This is something that a democracy does not do. And I think to call Israel a democracy is to besmirch the very concept of democracy.
And sometimes, I mean, these things that you're talking about, they're all laws, they're all legal, and then sometimes Israel disregards even its own legal and judicial institutions and rulings. Talk about the raid of Bab al-Shams in early 2013.
Well, that was a protest camp that was set up in E2, which is an area east of Jerusalem, which is privately owned Palestinian land. And the state of Israel, under Netanyahu, wants to extend this mega-settlement called Male Adumim into this land to basically cut off Jerusalem completely from the West Bank, which would totally sever what was supposed to be the future Palestinian capital from what was supposed to be the rest of the Palestinian state. It would be the death knell of the two-state solution. And it is already dead, in my opinion. I mean, it's obviously dead. But this would have been just kind of the final nail in the coffin. And it's going ahead. So some Palestinian youth and activists set up a protest camp and basically said, we're going to build our own settlement here. They brought in enough equipment to actually live there, tents, generators, and you know, medical facilities and so on. And they said, we're demonstrating our right to live on our own land. The Israeli Supreme Court ruled that they could be there, not indefinitely, but they'd struck down a request from the Israeli government for the demolition of these camps. And the Israeli government went ahead and sent in riot police who arrested everyone very violently, destroyed their tents, and pushed them, pretty much swept them away so that they could continue with plans to build this mega settlement. And that's just one of countless examples of the Israeli government and military, particularly the military, disregarding Supreme Court rulings. The Supreme Court rulings, to me, are just kind of like a suggestion. But when the Supreme Court, for instance, banned The use of 22 caliber Ruger rifles in the West Bank that the Israeli military had been using to kind of break the bones of Palestinian protesters. The military didn't stop for a day in using these rifles. I've seen them myself, and I've seen the casualties. When the Supreme Court issued limitations on assassinations in the West Bank, the Israeli military proceeded to carry out assassinations of suspects who had not yet even been convicted. And when a young woman named Anat Kam, who was working in an office in the Israeli military, discovered evidence that these assassinations were continuing and provided that evidence to a journalist named Uri Blau for Haaretz, she went to jail. She went to jail for revealing that the military was violating a Supreme Court order, and Uri Blau nearly went to jail himself for reporting it, and actually was forced out of the country for some time. So, again, these are not features of a democratic society. These are features of the most militarized society on Earth.
You talk about something that you call the military media complex, which I think you've just alluded to. What does that look like? How much freedom is there in the Israeli media?
Well, the Israeli media has, they technically have freedom of the press, but the question is, who is the press? And the press, in a lot of ways, blurs the line between the military's own propaganda arm and the media. We saw that in the U.S. after 9/11. We continue to see it on ISIS, and we saw it on Iraq. But in Israel, it's more extreme because members of the press often are in the military themselves, reservists, and they are living in this very small tribalistic society. So when there's a war, they compete with one another, particularly the military correspondents, to promote the military's line and its propaganda as aggressively as possible. And so you see the Israeli military introduce manipulations and fabrications about Palestinian human shields, about the Free Gaza flotillas that are, consist of international activists bringing aid to Gaza, actually containing weapons. And the Israeli media, the supposedly independent media, dutifully reproducing press releases from the Israeli military and then really drilling into the Israeli public's minds that they're besieged on all sides, that their wars were completely just, and that all of the civilian casualties justified. And in the most recent war in Gaza, this is played out in such an extreme fashion that the military's press arm and the media were completely indistinguishable. And then you have reporters and commentators who number, I can pretty much number them on my hands, who resist the push to do propaganda for the military, who criticize the military and stand against the tide, like Gideon Levy. He's the most prominent one for Haaretz. He's a columnist. He's actually a former speechwriter for Shimon Peres and a former functionary of the Labor Party who's become one of the most prominent dissidents in Israeli society. And during this war, he criticized the Israeli Air Force for carrying out these bombing missions that were targeting civilian homes who were responsible for the liquidation of those 89 families I mentioned earlier. And, having existed in the Gaza Strip under the Israeli bombing, as I did this summer, I can tell you that the bombings and the targeting was completely indiscriminate. So Levy criticized the Air Force, which happens to be the most revered institution in Israeli society, and received so many death threats that Haaretz actually had to pay for a bodyguard to appear with him in public. And that's how Gideon Levy interacts with the public now. He has to be protected. And this was the case for other journalists. Journalists during the war were attacked for perceived opposition to the war. Even if they actually supported the war, they found themselves under attack, besieged by mobs, and threatened with their lives. So it's not necessarily government repression as much as the mob mentality that intimidates the media or pushes the media to merge with the Israeli military.
We're talking to author and journalist Max Blumenthal, talking about his book, Goliath, Life and Loathing in Greater Israel. The public expressions of racism, from public squares to the legislature to soccer stadiums, not to mention the internet, seems to be completely uninhibited and mainstream. What are some examples of that you saw firsthand?
Yeah, there are no limits on incitement to genocide in Israeli society, particularly in times of war, or attacks on the few leftist forces who try to stand against the tide of war and militarism. You know, in the past, some of my left-wing Israeli friends had said that my analysis went too far, it was too severe. But after this war, I found them telling me that they simply wanted to leave Israel, and that I was unfortunately right. And during this war, you heard Ayelet Shaked, who is the whip for the third largest party in Israel, the Jewish Home Party, call for the extermination of Palestinian mothers to prevent them from giving birth to little snakes. Mordechai Kadar, who is an Israeli government-linked Arabist, meaning he's considered an expert on Arab society, who teaches at Bar-Ilan University in Israel, calling rape of the mothers and sisters of terror suspects and Palestinian men to prevent them from committing acts of violence against Israeli civilians. We saw Rabbi Noam Perel of B'nai Akiva, the largest religious nationalist organization in the world, call for the for 300 Palestinian foreskins to be delivered as proof that they were massacred, invoking the biblical tale of Phineas. Rabbi Dov Lior, a state-sponsored Israeli rabbi from Hebron, recently delivered a speech at a settlement calling for the annihilation of Palestinians. These calls were so common that I can't even... it would take me the rest of the broadcast to even get through one quarter of them. And my colleague David Sheen has done a really excellent job of documenting them. But then there were the street attacks on leftists who protested in Tel Aviv against the war. And these were actually organized attacks through Facebook pages like Order 8. Order 8 is the call that Israeli reservists receive when they're called up to duty. But a right-wing rapper in Israel named The Shadow set up an organizing hub for attacks on those he called traitors, called Order 8. The photographs of prominent leftists were put on this Facebook page, and were followed home, small right-wing mobs, and beaten at their doorstep after being attacked at demonstrations. You know, this occurred throughout the war, as well as the Facebook outings of those who had written on their own Facebook pages in opposition of the war. So there was an effort to out people as traitors, which led to the firing of scores of Israelis, mostly Palestinian citizens of Israel, who were government employees who had spoken against the war. And the atmosphere of intimidation has peaked to an unprecedented degree. I mean, what I describe in my book, Goliath, sets the landscape or sets the stage for what happened this summer, but it didn't even begin to capture the intensity of repression and intimidation and the eliminationist attitude that pervaded throughout Jewish Israeli society.
It's just so horrifying. I mean, in a couple of generations after the Holocaust that we're seeing this, you write about a study from a psychological study from Tel Aviv University in which the professor who did this study basically characterized Jewish Israeli consciousness as having a sense of victimization, a siege mentality, blind patriotism, belligerence, self-righteousness, dehumanization of Palestinians, insensitivity to their suffering. It seems like the Holocaust isn't being used so much as a cautionary tale against the evils of racism, as I learned in school, as so many of us did here in the United States, but rather as a justification, almost, to perpetrate those same kinds of evils.
It's not surprising that the victims of a genocide could develop a genocidal mentality when they come in control of another people who they are threatened by. It's not surprising that the narrative of a genocide could be warped and exploited to produce nationalism and militarism and demonization of the other. And Israelis aren't unique in this regard at all. I mean, our own narrative of the foundation of the United States has been exploited for militaristic and nationalistic purposes, and it continues to contribute to the immiseration of Americans and every other group that doesn't fit in. So when people say, how could the people who've suffered so much cause so much suffering to me, it seems like the question, the answer is self-evident. The narrative of the Holocaust that I was raised on is universal. It means that You can simply apply the evils of the Holocaust to any situation as a warning of what can happen, particularly when incitement is in the air and racism is in the air. It means never again to anyone. In Israel, the official narrative of the Holocaust is never again only to Jews. And, you know, you couple that with famous expressions in Israeli society like Ein Brera, which means there's no other choice. And you have a really dangerous scenario. Benjamin Netanyahu is the master of the segregationist narrative of the Holocaust. And last year, in October, he stood before an audience of Israeli college students at the Bar-Ilan University in a nationally televised address on national security and claimed that the Palestinian national leadership bears the spirit of Hitler and the Nazis. And he repeated this narrative at the UN General Assembly just last week. He first linked Hamas to ISIS, then linked somehow Hamas and ISIS to Iran, then linked it all back to the Holocaust and Nazi Germany. And this is a narrative that's been pipelined into the psyche of so many young Jewish Israelis, 25% or more, according to the Israeli Education Ministry, of Israeli high school students have been on the March of the Living, which is a march through Auschwitz that's conducted alongside uniformed Israeli military personnel with F-16s from the Israeli Air Force flying overhead. And it's just a week of Holocaust indoctrination that is designed by the Israeli military to produce more nationalistic and militaristic attitudes. And the Education Ministry has found, because they monitor attitudes, that the youth who go into the trip with skeptical attitudes about the military and nationalism, which is sort of normal, come out with higher support for the Jewish state and a more positive view of the military. So that's really how the Holocaust is used, and what they've done, what Zionism itself has done, is sap the Holocaust of its meaning and warped its narrative into something that can be wielded against another people who are besieged and ghettoized and demonized and racially outcasted. That's the Palestinians.
It's interesting because you write about how young people, when they were brought on this Holocaust tour and brought to Auschwitz, became more nationalistic, whereas career military adults actually started to question more after the exact same tour.
Right. This was a tour, and these are statistics that baffled Israeli researchers, and I think they just don't want to recognize the reality, which is that when career military officers were taken to Auschwitz for the same tour, their nationalistic attitudes and respect for the military plummeted. These were people who led battalions into the West Bank, who participated in the project of domination and control of the Palestinian people, who saw horrible things. And, you know, these soldiers often suppressed the suffering they experienced from causing suffering to other people in order to go on. And I think that they may have seen themselves in some of the exhibitions and seen a vision of themselves that was harrowing. That's my only explanation for why they were so disturbed, not only by the exhibitions on the Holocaust, but by their own line of work.
In the Israeli legislature, the Knesset, there are artworks, as you write about, depicting the European Jewish genocide and ignoring the rich and varied history of Jewish life in the Arab world. Tell us a little more about that rich and varied Jewish life and life of coexistence.
Well, I mean, it wasn't a perfect life, but the Jewish history in the Arab world is ignored and excised from the Zionist narrative because it's threatening, because Jews there were hundreds of thousands of Jews who were Arabs, who spoke Arabic, who lived in Arab societies alongside Christians and Muslims. The most famous Jewish religious thinker ever, Maimonides, was one of them, and he died in Cairo. He was corresponding with the Islamic polymath Ibn Rushd. So there is this rich history, and what Zionism has sought to do is to destroy the Levantine Bridge between Arab Jews and Arab Muslims. It's the greatest threat, I think, to Zionism, which is a segregationist movement which aims to exploit the resentment of Jews from Arab countries, many of whom were expelled from those countries because of the foundation of the State of Israel and the anger it provoked, and to turn them into kind of loyal citizens in a European-run society, in a society run by people like me who are Jews of European descent, or Ashkenazi. And now what you see in Israel is a group known as the Mizrahim, who are, you know, Jews mostly from Arab countries, from the East, who are the most racist towards Arabs, who reject any idea of having an Arab heritage, who are the base of the Likud party and parties even further to the right, and who form the core of the lowest level battalions in the Israeli military, which are put in charge of the West Bank and doing the real grunt work of occupying people, and who are responsible for the most documented abuses. And it's just this incredibly sad story of this group of people who are discriminated against within Jewish Israeli society, seeking to demonstrate their loyalty to that society's upper class in order to receive benefits. And the only way to demonstrate loyalty and receive benefits, or the best way, is to kick down the one group that's below you, and that's Palestinians. That's the one group that everyone can unite against in this society where people are actually not very united and are so filled with resentment to each other, whether it's Ethiopian Jews or Mizrahi Jews or Russian Jews. It's not a very cohesive society. It gains its identity by seeing itself in opposition to the other, to the Palestinians. And that really helps explain the tragedy and destruction of Arab-Jewish life.
It's tragic on so many levels, because although the suffering of Jewish people in Israel today really can't be compared to the suffering of Palestinian people, the amount of hatred and animosity and ill will that is cultivated is also incredibly unhealthy as a society. I mean, as you say, it's a fragmented society, but what does that spectrum of society look like? Do you see a coherent peace movement? I know we have this sort of peace process, which seems kind of like a joke, but do you see any kind of kindness and rationality?
No. It only exists within marginalized quarters, and it exists in opposition to everything that surrounds it because of what the Jewish state has done over the course of its existence, which is just promote separation according to its logical imperatives and those of Zionism. What I think the right-wing government is seeking to do, because it obviously rejects a two-state solution, and the Israeli government, whether left or right, has never really wanted a real Palestinian state to come into being with sovereignty. But having scrapped torpedoed a two-state solution, they want to guarantee a single apartheid state, a unitary state based on Jewish legal supremacy. And in order to do that, they have to destroy any basis for the vision that I believe in and that I think humane people around the world believe in, which is a binational state with equal rights for Jews, Christians, Muslims, and everyone. And in order to destroy that vision, you have to produce attitudes that make coexistence impossible. And that's what we're seeing in these past few years, is just the rapid radicalization of the new post-Oslo generation, whether through education or through just sheer violence. And I think that's the ultimate tragedy, but it doesn't mean that it's not necessarily fatal. What I think your listeners should be looking for is not a peace movement, because peace can take many forms. It can often take the form of the submission of the oppressed. What they should be looking for is a justice movement. And justice, achieving justice, often requires force. It often requires violent force, or it can require another kind of force. Martin Luther King talked about soul force as the force behind his movement. And there is a movement in our society, And I think the fight really takes place here. It's boycott, divestment, and sanctions. And it aims to apply pressure through civil society on Israeli institutions that are involved in the occupation and on any company that's involved in the occupation of Palestine. Companies like Veolia, it's helping deny them contracts in other countries to force them to give up on the West Bank. And I think that's where the movement should start towards producing justice in the Holy Land. Force has to be applied. It's just a question of what kind of force we want to use, and I prefer nonviolent force.
We're talking to author Max Blumenthal. The U.S. has given unwavering support and untold billions of dollars to Israel. There has been a very strong fight against the boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement, and there has been a very imbalanced reporting about the various wars in Gaza and the whole situation in the United States. So there's a lot of work to do here at home.
Well, we have to do the work, you know, if you care about a just solution, you have to do the work that your government is not only failing to do, but which your government is fighting. The U.S. government is empowering radicals in Jewish society and in Islamic society in the Middle East. I mean, it's empowering radicals in Saudi Arabia, and it's empowering radicals in Israel, and it's empowering the radical repressive junta in Cairo, giving them weapons, training, and moral support, and diplomatic protection at every level. And so it's really up to us. I mean, we've been betrayed by our government on so many levels, not only on Israel-Palestine, but on inequality in our own communities, on civil liberties, on climate change. And so the BDS movement is really, I think, one of the central pillars in finally regaining empowerment in our own communities, on our campuses, in our own institutions, in our houses of worship, and saying enough, drawing the line and saying we won't comply anymore, and that we're going to do the job that you've done, that you've failed to do. And it's working. I mean, as I mentioned, Veolia, one of the key companies that's active in the West Bank, it basically dumps Israeli garbage in Palestinian rural communities. It's a French company, and it's doing really well in the stock market. It just got a $750 million contract canceled in Kuwait under BDS pressure. And we've seen scores of performers cancel their performances in Tel Aviv during the war. So there's success after success, and it really, I think, is empowering to people who feel betrayed by their government here.
Is your book available in Israel, and have you been back to Israel since it was published?
I was just in Israel. I was in the West Bank. I was in the Gaza Strip. My book is known among those who read English and are engaged in the issue in the Israeli media, yet it got so few reviews, mainly just received attacks. One figure, Akiva Elder, who is the chief political correspondent for Haaretz, one of Israel's four major papers, for 35 years, gave my book one of its best reviews. And that review was kind of ignored. He said my book explained the reality that highlighted the reality that he's grown existing in for decades, which had faded into the background of his life like a bas relief. So it has been acknowledged quietly, but I don't have any interest really in promoting it in Israel, and I wouldn't do so in accordance with BDS guidelines. I can just tell you that when I was coming out of the Gaza Strip after a day of bombing, I went through the Erez checkpoint, and you literally walk out of a walled-off ghetto that is perched with remote-controlled machine guns. You walk out from under the drones, which are over your head all the time, and you come out on the other side, and you're in what's known as Israel. And a camera crew from Israeli Channel 1 was just there waiting for journalists to emerge and interviewed me, started asking me all these questions about, you know, what it's like, and started kind of interrogating me, and I just kind of walked away. who showed little interest in speaking to Israeli society and trying to convince them, when so many forces and so many institutions are pushing in the other direction. And those forces are insurmountable as long as we're acting on our own and trying to appeal to the better angels of Jewish Israelis. It's just not possible. We actually have to challenge the institutions themselves and the Jewish state itself and force it to radically change in order to have any chance of being able to speak to Israelis about the injustices they're committing against Palestinians. I mean, they just can't see it. It's very difficult to have a dialogue as this entire system, which is a totalistic system that goes from education to the military to religious life, is in place.
Do you see any movement or change among American Jews who have been very strongly supporting Israel because of that beautiful initial idea of Israel that they had in their minds after World War II?
American Jews don't, at this point, support Israel because of any beautiful idea. They support it because their own identity in the U.S. is evanescent. They're looking for an identity. They're less religious than ever. They're unaffiliated with congregations. There's nothing to rally around. And then there's Israel. And there are free trips taking them to Israel. There are all these programs funded by supporters of the Jewish State of Israel and the Levant, or JSIL, to radicalize Jewish American youth and give them an identity. And that's an easy thing to do. I've been there. You know, I went on the free Birthright Israel trip, and they attempted to radicalize me. I was even offered the chance to live in a settlement. But I turned away from it after examining the reality. You know, you get away from identity politics and you start looking at, you know, justice politics and class politics and just reality politics. And, you know, it led me to anti-Zionism. I think that's the only natural response to such a hideous situation, is to oppose the philosophy that animates it. And I'm seeing so many young Jews come to the same conclusion, or at least they're on the fence. And if you look at Pew polls of Jewish American attitudes that recently came out, or even polls of pulpit rabbis, established pulpit rabbis, a majority of Jewish Americans no longer believe that the Israeli government is serious about peace. Only 40% of Jews, according to the latest Pew poll, believe that Israel is the promised land. That's in contrast to 82% of American evangelicals. And only 8% of secular American Jews believe Israel is the promised land, a land promised to the Jews by God. So we're not only seeing changes in attitudes, we're seeing changes in activism. We're the most rapidly emerging Jewish group on this issue of Israel-Palestine is Jewish Voice for Peace, which is pushing the boycott. It's pushing BDS. And it's growing so rapidly on American campuses, they can't even keep track of all the activists they're gaining. So the question is, how will all this activism and all this energy in support of the rights of Palestinians be manifested? And I think, you know, we're getting to a tipping point at the grassroots level, but then we still have to deal with this government, which is run by an elite, the elite, and which is determined to prevent us from manifesting any grassroots energy we can build, whether it's on this issue or on prison reform or on inequality or on climate change.
Max Blumenthal is a journalist, blogger, and Nation Institute writing fellow whose work has appeared in many publications, including the New York Times, the Los Angeles Times, the Nation, the Daily Beast, and the Huffington Post. His new book is called Goliath, Life and Loathing in Greater Israel. He will be at the Lenzik Center for Performing Arts in Santa Fe this Friday, the 10th of October, sponsored by the Lannan Foundation, but it is sold out. However, the event will be recorded and will be broadcast on Sunday, the 19th of October at 3:30 in the afternoon, right here on KSFR. Max Blumenthal, thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thanks for having me.